Hello and welcome aboard another episode of the Gallant Says podcast live at youtube.com/PaulGallant or twitch.tv/GallantSays. Weeknights around 6 o'clock, although we're starting this thing at 7 Central. It's also available wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. And if you have any thoughts that you want to share with the show, you can get them at me, GallantSays@gmail.com, tweeting me at GallantSays on Twitter or on Instagram and TikTok. It's Wednesday, May 3rd. I'm going to tell you why an NFL head coach should be canceled for a poor choice of words. I winked when I said it. Maybe I'm being sarcastic. Another brief conversation inspired by an unemployed cable news host. And we'll discuss a movie that I found out about literally this morning that's exciting me way too much. But first, let's talk about a NFL story that I saw this morning that has to do with the Carolina Panthers and why they took Bryce Young with the number one overall pick in the NFL draft. Obviously, a lot of interest here in Houston about that pick, maybe for my Seattle listeners as well, who were wondering if one of those quarterbacks might slide to them at 5 so that they wouldn't take Devin Witherspoon, the cornerback. Maybe you're also fascinated by it. Look, I just really enjoy NFL general managers explaining the moment that they fell in love with a prospect, because 10 times out of 10, the non-football reasons that they will speak into existence sound hilarious, even if they're true. And of course, you want to hear a general manager say all of the obvious things. We like what he is as a quarterback, but when these guys talk about other things that they saw that felt like it gave them a look behind the kimono and into these guys' souls, I think it's really funny. And the latest example of this came on an episode of PFTPM, where Mike Florio of Pro Football Talk interviewed Carolina Panthers general manager Scott Fitterer. And here is the part of the interview that really fascinated me. Fitterer talks about a dinner that the Panthers had with Bryce Young.
The one thing that stands out is probably a dinner the night before his pro day. And we're sitting in a restaurant and we're talking to him. And this is the first time, you know, you've interviewed him at the combine in a, you know, 18-minute interview. We've talked to him at other places. But this is the time you see him in a social setting where we're sitting around a table and we're really just getting to know the guy, and he's holding court. You know, we had a couple hour dinner with him. And as you're sitting there at dinner, you're just looking at this guy, and I'm thinking in my head the whole time, okay, is this the right guy for us? Is this the guy that we want kind of be in our face? Is he the one we want leading our team, you know, in the huddle when it's the fourth quarter? And you have all these questions in your head as you're sitting at dinner, just watching him talk to other people. And that was kind of the moment that I had personally where I thought, okay, this is the guy. This is the guy that we want leading the team.
So from Scott Fitterer, there was a moment as he stared across the table looking at Bryce Young, and Bryce Young's talking to everybody with the Carolina Panthers there, where he just knew that Bryce was the one. You ever had a moment like that with a significant other? You're at a table, you're listening to them talk, and you're maybe no longer listening to what they're even saying. You're just watching their mouth something, and you're maybe thinking either impure thoughts or about how this is the love of my life. That is essentially what Scott Fitterer said right there. And I gotta say, it makes me laugh because it reminds me of another moment in recent NFL history where it seems like a general manager got way too excited about something that, if we're being honest, it's totally fucking stupid to be excited about. You might remember that Ryan Pace used to be the general manager of the Chicago Bears. And in a press conference that he did after the Bears traded a lot to move up to the number 2 overall pick and draft Mitchell Trubisky. Towards the tail end of that press conference, he was asked about something that stood out with Trubisky. Here is the former, keyword former, that's what happens when you draft Mitchell Trubisky, general manager of the Chicago Bears.
We're on the video on the team website talking about his beat up car.
So we go to dinner and we're walking out to the parking lot, all of us, and he's walking towards his car and he starts laughing, and like there's some hubcaps that are missing and the thing's just kind of falling apart, and we joked at that moment, like, hey, you need to bring this car to Chicago, don't change. And he's like, I don't know if it's going to make it to Chicago. And I said, I don't care if you have to change the engine, but you got to keep the shell, you know, bring the, yeah, so hopefully he brings it. So
well, guess what, guys? He did bring it. You could argue that his overall play for the Chicago Bears and then with the Pittsburgh Steelers was very, I don't know, similar to a beat-up piece of shit Toyota Camry. But, hey, that would just be your eyeballs talking. We're not talking about Mitchell Trubisky, the human. We're talking about Mitchell Trubisky, the quarterback that, through no fault of his own, ended up being the second overall pick in an NFL draft that also featured Patrick Mahomes and Deshaun Watson. I feel bad for Trubisky. He doesn't seem like he's some dick like Ryan Leaf was when he played in the league. Like, Ryan Leaf failing is something that I think a lot of people maybe look at and you're like, yeah, I mean, I don't mind that he failed. Credit to him. I know he was on our station earlier this morning. He seems to have learned from his experience, but he also seems like he was a massive asshole back in the day. Whatever. Sometimes it takes, I don't know, drug addiction and a prison sentence to humble you just a little bit. Anyway, Mitchell Trubisky did indeed bring this car to Chicago. Here's a picture of it that the Bears Twitter account put out. Got to drive your former grandma's car to Hallis Hall. And he kept it even after the draft. Listen, nothing wrong with the mid-90s Toyota Camry. I had a mid-90s Toyota Camry myself. I also, at one point, after my sister was visiting in town one weekend and she totaled the car, I also used to have a 1991 Honda with one of those automatic seatbelt things. And every single time I tried to start the car, if it was exposed to direct sunlight, it wouldn't start because a bubble would pop up, I guess, in the line that feeds the gas to the ignition or something like that. It was annoying. I would have to physically go behind the car and shake it and then try to start it. And I would usually end up sweating in the hot Florida sun a shit ton out of that. Anyway, there was a big deal made out of Mitchell Trubisky's car by Bear staff. And that's not the only reason they drafted him, but they thought, hey, this guy's humble. This guy gets it. And naturally, like you will probably be seeing over the next couple of months if you're here in Houston when it comes to CJ Stroud, or if you're elsewhere when it comes to any of the other quarterbacks, you're going to see a lot of blogs about things that these guys did in college that speak about their character and it hopeful thinking, wishful thinking that this character is going to lend itself to them being an actually good football player. Here is a blog. It is written by the unfortunate, sorry for you, bro, Ryan Van Bibber, May 11th of 2017 for SB Nation. And I need to read a function, a passage. A car serves one function, getting you from point A to point B. In selecting an automobile, it is my personal feeling that the two most important factors are reliability and fuel efficiency. Yes, if you're a poor. If you're a poor. I'm a poor. My car's got scratches. It's beat up. All the hubcaps look terrible. But let's be honest. That's something you think about if you don't have money. If you have money, buy something nice. There are many other vehicles that Trubisky could have shown up in, like the Camry, Honda Accord, Ford Focus, practical vehicles to own. And this is where the write-up about Trubisky's car really gets me going. Since he's young and childless, he doesn't need to worry much about space. It's refreshing to see a young man taking advantage of that fact. Not only is he saving money on gas, he continues, this writer, since it's his grandma's car, he's not making a car payment. You know who's not losing 30% of the value of his car as soon as it drives off the lot? Mitchell Trubisky. More money to pay off his offensive lineman with Casio watches, 32-inch televisions. Jesus, 32-inch televisions? That's it? Xbox 360s and other consumer ephemera to entice them into keeping him upright. Maybe that's sarcastic, because these aren't, none of those things are good, right? Anyway, Mitchell Trubisky, big time Toyota Camry guy. That's one of the reasons that the Bears were sold on Mitchell Trubisky, the man, much like that dinner that Bryce Young had with the Carolina Panthers is a reason that the Panthers were sold on him, or at least that was the moment they knew. I don't know. The moment I knew was when I went to that game against Texas that Alabama played and saw Bryce Young doing all sorts of superhuman stuff while running for his life against a really good Texas defensive line that day. But that's just me. This doesn't mean Bryce Young is going to fail like Mitchell Trubisky. I just think it's funny that they liked how Young comported himself at dinner. This has happened before with other NFL teams, and there is zero tie between that and what a guy does on the field. Also, I don't want to know why the Texans fell in love with CJ Stroud. I really don't. We're only going to be disappointed. You know what else is disappointing? Pittsburgh Steelers head coach Mike Tomlin, who may need to be canceled. Yeah! How dare Mike Tomlin use the word goon to describe a human being? Many would argue that's coded language. A write-up about a conference call that Wisconsin defensive tackle Keanu Benton, now a Pittsburgh Steeler, did went viral the last couple of days. Benton said this of his play: "Talking to Coach Tomlin, the main thing I had taken away is that he wants goons out there, and he wants somebody to come out there who's not afraid to get their nose dirty. And I feel like I am the best option for that guy," he said in that post-draft pick conference call. Said Tomlin when he heard that Benton had said this, "That's an accurate description. But I'll give him some media training so he can keep some of our private conversation private." What's there to keep private, Mike? That you love to use demeaning words towards men to describe what you want out of a football player? This isn't the first time that you've dropped the G-bomb. Here he is on a podcast with Ben Roethlisberger doing the exact same thing.
They call it A7s, man. It's based out of like Eastern Pennsylvania, Maryland, Jersey. And it is tackle football, no pads.
That's
it
awesome.
Is awesome. It is online. A7s.
No pads.
No pads.
No helmet.
These guys are goons.
Whoa. Excuse you, sir. Those are working class men with 9-to-5 jobs, who were just going out playing football against one another. How dare you, Mike? How dare you? They are more than what you call goons. They have families. They have lives, hobbies, interests, and people who love them. And you're going to drop a G-bomb on them? Outrageous. Now, Tomlin actually clarified this today, which is why I became aware of his love of the word goon. In an appearance with Willie Colon on Sirius XM Mad Dog Radio, which is one of those radio companies that doesn't actually post clips that they do of interviews and doesn't give you the access to actually get the audio from it. So this is what he told Willie Colon, what he looks for with a goon. "A better person to define goon is sitting there with you. Willie Colon shaped my perspective on what appropriate gooning is. To be bluntly honest, this dude played with an edge. He could be characterized as a mean person on the football field, but always in control, always calculated, always smart. I think that's the gist of what I'm talking about. We have to play with a certain collective demeanor, but we've also got to play and play to win. And that means not beating yourself. So that means bringing a certain level of intellect to the physicality, something Willie mastered. You know, he's a sharp guy. He conducts business with you guys every day and does it at a very high level," said Tomlin. "But to be able to do those things and play the game with a certain edge, a certain demeanor is things that we covet." You hear that description, and unless you couldn't sense the sarcasm a little bit earlier. We all know what Mike Tomlin was actually looking for with the word goon. You're looking for somebody who's tough, who maybe enjoys beating the shit out of other players on the football field, but isn't going to do it in some dumb way like a Dylan Brooks or some of the other noted cheap shot artists of the recent NFL. Say Vontaze Burfict in Cincinnati. But that word is a problematic word in the eyes of some, and I do find it fascinating because whenever somebody uses that word to describe what they're looking for in an athlete on the field, basketball, it's generally some Bill Laimbeer type of enforcer. In hockey, it's somebody who's probably on the fourth line. He's going to drop gloves at the soonest chance that he gets. And of course, football, it's probably someone who plays a little bit dirty. Baseball, I wonder what a goon would be. Pitcher who throws high heat. Kind of difficult to figure out how to be a goon on the baseball field. Spikes up whenever he slides into a base. I'm not 100% sure. But like the word prison, whether it's Bob McNair or NFL league meetings talking about Colin Kaepernick or someone else, there are certain words that are going to trigger some. Here's an interaction that I had with my former coworker, G. Scott. I was rewatching the NFL game between the Seahawks and Packers that ended with the fail Mary. I said, based on prison rules, that's a catch. G. Scott responds to me in his typical passive-aggressive fashion with the quotation marks of the word prison. And I told him, well, I've been to the gulag in Call of Duty, bro. You don't know what it's like. But I remember seeing that and I was just fucking annoyed, to be perfectly honest. Because everyone has a general idea of what the word prison rules means. It basically means none. There's a lot of sayings out there that we hear in 2023 and you understand the meaning, even if it's not specifically in very, very, very obvious terms describing exactly what somebody is trying to describe. There are all sorts of sayings in our language that the majority of people have a pretty good understanding of. Inmates running the prison with Bob McNair, that was a statement that I'd never heard of, but I have heard of inmates running the asylum. And this is language that I think sometimes gets focused on when it doesn't actually need to be focused on. Because it's way more important for us to understand our actual history in every situation we can. Because are we not often repeating ourselves when it comes to history? But to understand the history of a word or some saying's meaning or origin, it's not always important to get to the bottom of that. It only is if someone truly doesn't quite get the gist of what you're trying to say. And I think that with a statement like that, whether it's goon or prison, I think more often than not today, people, when they see that in writing, will choose to get mad at the statement or make passive-aggressive, what do you mean comments, like that tweet from G I pointed out, when they actually understand exactly what you're saying. And instead of saying like, hey, maybe you shouldn't use this, they're going to do it like that so that they can feel morally superior. Had someone explained that to me, I would have listened, you know? But it's one of those things where people are not often looking at the statement and trying to read it as what the statement is. They're trying to find a way to be offended with the way that the English language is. And this is not me bitching and moaning about cancel culture or something like that. I just think that people go about it the wrong way if they want people to maybe understand where a specific saying came from. There's a lot of weird ones out there that are interesting when it comes to the history. For example, long time no see. That was a saying that began, I guess, in the 1800s in reference to Asian immigrants who were working on railroads on the western half of the United States. So it began as that, and now all of a sudden, long time no see has become a foundational saying in the English language. Maybe foundational is extreme, but you know, you get what I'm saying. A very common saying in the English language. And it came from something that maybe wasn't the best. That's it. The word goon is a lot of words that are similar to it. And I thought to myself, well, what do these words actually mean? Get a little extra history involved with the words of our language. Because you hear goon, you hear thug, you hear brute, gangster, among others. Goon, a stupid, foolish, or eccentric person. But the North American definition, a violent, aggressive person who is hired to intimidate or harm people. It may have been influenced by the subhuman cartoon character Alice the Goon, created by a early 1900s American cartoonist. But the word goon also stands for cheap wine in Australia when sold in large cartons. Apparently that's a common saying. What else do we have? Words like goon, thug, a violent, aggressive person, especially one who is a criminal. You could interpret it as that. Or a member of a group or organization of robbers and assassins in India who waylaid and strangled their victims, usually travelers, and stole their belongings. They were suppressed by the British, of course, in the 1830s. Huh, that's an interesting one. How about the word brute? Bad guys. Halo. The actual definition, a savagely violent person or animal. A cruel or insensitive person, something awkward, difficult, or unpleasant. Or, this is where it gets a little bit problematic, an animal as opposed to a human being characterized by an absence of reasoning or intelligence. Yep, definitely hear that term a lot in football circles. Probably not the best one to use. Thug. Remember when people were calling Marshawn Lynch a thug and Richard Sherman a thug? Not the best look. I like to think that it wasn't a lot of people out there that were doing it, and I like to think that we've kind of slowed our roll when it comes to characterizing players as that. But the word goon is something that a lot of teams will look for from time to time in the athletes that they decide to draft or employ. Gangster, pretty obvious. A member of a gang of violent criminals. But it's a word that over time, the word gangster, you could say, man, that's gangster, to describe something that you actually think is cool. About the word ruffian, a violent criminal or troublemaker. Maybe we need to bring back the word ruffian when it comes to what you're looking for in an NFL player. If you're looking for a goon or a thug or a brute, how about a ruffian? It's the same thing. It's an Italian word. Ruffiano, which became ruffian in Old French, which became ruffian in the early 16th century. Hooligan, a violent young troublemaker, typically one of a gang. Hooligan has been used a lot over the last couple of years, but generally it refers to soccer fans who are violent. Violent's still there. Vandal, a person who deliberately destroys or damages public or private property. Yeah, probably not going to work as much as the word goon. Or a member of a Germanic people that ravaged Gaul, Spain, and North Africa in the 4th to 5th centuries and sacked Rome in 455 AD. And then you've got the word hood, which is an abbreviation of a hoodlum, a gangster, a similarly violent criminal. I think we need to bring back hoodlum, ruffian, and vandal. Although a vandal won't work. So ruffian, hood, and hooligan. Let's bring them back. Until they ultimately get stopped because it's problematic language. While we're on violence and problematic language, get a load of this guy's violent thoughts. Yeah! Back-to-back days, we're going to be talking about unemployed former news cable hosts Tucker Carlson, who is still getting reamed over the coals. Now for a text that he sent a producer that may have gotten him fired. This is what the text read, January 7th of 2021 at 4:18. A couple of weeks ago, I was watching video of people fighting on the street in Washington. A group of Trump's guys surrounded an Antifa kid and started pounding the living shit out of him. It was 3 against 1, at least. Jumping a guy like that is dishonorable, obviously. It's not how white men fight. Motherfucker, why would you text this to anyone? Worded as detailed as this, let alone a coworker. Putting something like that in writing, for those who do believe Tucker Carlson is super intelligent, I think he's smart, but that's just fucking dumb. Doesn't matter what the rest of this text says, and it's a long fucking text. It just matters what you say there. How would you have such a lack of judgment to post that? Continues the text. Here's what's even worse. Suddenly I found myself rooting for the mob against the man. The Trump guys beating the shit out of the Antifa kid. Oh my God. I could taste it. Then somewhere deep in my brain, an alarm went off. This isn't good for me. I'm becoming something I don't want to be. The Antifa creep is a human being. Much as I despise what he says and does, much as I'm sure I'd hate him personally if I knew him, I shouldn't gloat over his suffering. I should be bothered by it. I should remember that somewhere, somebody probably loves this kid and would be crushed if he was killed. I don't care about those things if I reduce people to their politics. How am I better than he is? So he's taking people through the thought of somebody who has a gut reaction and then realizes, man, I'm pretty fucked up for thinking this, right? But why, again, would you put any of this in writing, and why would you send this to a producer in written form? Who knows? But a lot of people were focusing on the how white men fight, and it's got me thinking about something that I love to discuss, history, and the history of the word duel, because that's how white people fight, with a duel, bitch, or at least they used to. Started way back in Viking times. The Holm Gang. Ever heard of that? It's a duel practiced by early medieval Scandinavians, a legally recognized way to settle disputes. In theory, someone offended could challenge another party to a Holm Gang, regardless of their differences in social status over honor, ownership, property, etc., etc. They were fought 3 to 7 days after the challenge. If the person challenged did not turn up for the Holm Gang, the other man was considered just in his challenge. If the offended party did not turn up for the Holm Gang, they were deemed Neoingner. No idea how to pronounce that. And could have been sentenced to outlawry. In effect, if someone was unwilling or unable to defend their claim, they had no honor. Sometimes a capable warrior volunteered to fight in the place of a clearly outclassed friend. Basically, some variant of a trial by combat, right? Kind of interesting that if the offended party doesn't turn up, they were deemed an outlaw. Seems like you could perhaps, if you were a super violent person, abuse this system a little bit. But you would have to be super good with a sword, I would imagine, to make that happen. More duels, more white people fighting. How white people fight. It's not three Trumpers on an Antifa guy. It's a duel. In medieval society, judicial duels were fought by knights and squires to end various disputes. France, Germany, Ireland practiced this tradition. There's something called a feat of arms. It's used to settle hostilities between two large parties and supervised by a judge. So it would be a battle fought as a result of a slight or challenge to one party's honor. The parties involved wear their own armor. They would use whatever weapons they want to fight. The duel lasted until one party could no longer fight back. In early cases, the defeated party would then be executed. Jesus, who would want to get in one of these? You get executed if you lose? Like, there's no chance for mercy? Then there's something called the passage of arms. You might have heard of this if you've watched the movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
None shall pass.
What?
None shall pass. None shall pass.
What?
None shall pass. None shall pass.
And you get the premise of it. All right, let's stop looping. That's random Facebook video that I'm playing this from. So that's essentially what the Black Knight was doing. The passage of arms. A knight or a group of knights would stake out a traveled spot, like a bridge or a city gate. Let it be known that any other knight who wished to pass must first fight or be disgraced. And if this person didn't have weapons or a horse, that might be provided. If they chose not to fight, you would have to leave your spurs behind as a sign of humiliation. Something else. More duel history. In 1770, a number of important changes in England took place. English duelists started using the pistol. In 1808, two Frenchmen are said to have fought in balloons over Paris, each attempting to shoot and puncture the other's balloon. One duelist is said to have been shot down and killed with his second. Wow, that sounds pretty fucking terrifying, but kind of cool. Must be a fucking rush to be flying high over Paris in a hot air balloon. September 22nd of 1842, future President Abraham Lincoln met to duel with State Auditor James Shields, but friends intervened. So Lincoln could have been in a duel before he ever became president, long before he became president. Imagine what world we'd be in without him having done that. 1843, two Frenchmen are said to have fought a duel by throwing billiard balls at each other. In the 1860s, Otto von Bismarck of the Germans was reported to have challenged a man to a duel. The man, who is entitled to choose the weapons, chose two pork sausages, one infected with the roundworm Trichinella. The two would choose and eat a sausage. So basically just really leaving it up to God. Bismarck declined. Maybe that wasn't real. Right to Wikipedia. In the late 19th and 20th centuries, pistol dueling became popular as a sport in France. Duelists were armed with conventional pistols, but the cartridges had wax bullets and were without any powder charge. The bullet was propelled only by the explosion of the cartridge's primer. Participants wore heavy protective clothing and a metal helmet with a glass eye screen. The pistols were fitted with a shield that protected the firing hand. Pistol dueling was a non-metal event at the 1908 Summer Olympics in London. Why don't we bring this back? Fuck yeah. It's pretty sick. Today, though, the only time that you'll see white people fight is what? Outside of a bar? Right? A couple of drunk people. By the way, there is something called a mutual combat law. This exists in two states that I've lived in. Washington and Texas. They're the only two states in the United States where mutual combat is legal. In Washington, said mutual combat must take place in a public place and both parties must agree to the fight. I don't know if it's different in Texas, but this allows dispute to be settled via consensual unarmed combat. Unarmed duels. Two places in the United States you can do it. I lived in both of them. Does that make me different? Yes. One last thing before I hit the road. You know who else used to duel, technically? Gladiators. That was a delayed Horatio Caine transition. Tell me this isn't going to be the greatest movie ever. Pedro Pascal is in final negotiations to join the untitled Gladiator sequel, joining Paul Mescal, who will star as Lucius, the young boy from the first movie. No idea who that is. Along with Barry Keoghan. Whoa. I don't know who that is either. But I do know that he played... Actually, check that. He was in Banshees of Inisherin. He was also the Joker in the most recent Batman movie, The Batman. Also in the movie, Joseph Quinn, Connie Nielsen. And here's where it really gets fucking lit with Ridley Scott directing this movie. Denzel Washington. Denzel Washington's going to be in the sequel to Gladiator. Pedro Pascal might be in it as well. Barry Keoghan. Who else is going to be in? I don't know, but Gladiator's one of my two favorite movies, Gladiator and Braveheart. It's not going to be quite the same without Russell Crowe and without Joaquin Phoenix, who was so fucking creepy. But that movie was nominated for 12 Oscars, won Best Picture. Russell Crowe won Best Actor. That movie was awesome. It still is awesome. I might need to watch it this weekend. And they're making a sequel to it. It's going to have Denzel Washington and Pedro Pascal in it. Sign me the fuck up. Anyway, that's going to wrap up today's edition of the Gallant Says podcast, which you can watch live weekdays 6 to 6:30, youtube.com/PaulGallant or twitch.tv/GallantSays. If you got any questions for the show, email me, GallantSays@gmail.com. You can also tweet me @GallantSays on Twitter or on Instagram, Sports Gallant. Politics Gallant also on Instagram. I got a couple of other accounts. I'm also on TikTok @GallantSays. You can get this in podcast form wherever you get your podcasts the next day. Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. So long, farewell, and have yourselves a wonderful Wednesday.
Peace.
And Thursday if you're listening in podcast form.
Peace.